America is the sole superpower, but it doesn't have a monopoly of wisdom in these areas, so the argument goes.
Yeah, we can blow them up to bits, but we're trying to free them, not to destroy them.
I think it's worth taking a risk. So I would encourage people to find out what they can do and do it.
Baghdad is a city that moves on with its daily business, much as though life is normal, and it's not a city and a country on the cusp of war.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, March 11th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Pakistan is seeking to convince the world that the arrest of two al-Qaeda leaders this month was not staged. A grainy video purporting to show the authenticity of the arrest has done little to deflect accusations that Pakistan may have staged the raid so it can abstain in a UN vote on an attack against Iraq. Yesterday, the powerful Military Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, held an unprecedented news conference to show foreign journalists what it said were images of a March 1st raid in Rawalpindi that netted al-Qaeda kingpin Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But few of the journalists were convinced the video, which did not show Mohammed's face nor any sign of a struggle, was genuine. Many said it looked like a crude reconstruction. Today, a former ISI chief said he believed Mohammed was actually arrested some time ago in a different city. Lieutenant General Hamid Gul told Reuters News, quote, "They are trying to cover up. I believe he was arrested before, probably in Karachi." Gul said news of the arrests appeared to have been leaked at a critical time, just as Pakistan was facing huge U.S. pressure to support a U.N. Security Council vote authorizing war on Iraq. The non-aligned nations are meeting at the U.N. today. In a session before the U.N. Security Council, Iraq refuted allegations in the U.S. press regarding weapons of mass destruction. Mohammed al-Dori, U.N. ambassador from Iraq, painstakingly referred to Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix's report point by point to answer assertions about the drone aircraft and other matters.
Regarding the so-called new evidence during the past 2 days, alleging that Iraq is in material breach, allegations made by the United States of America and Great Britain, I believe that this so-called new evidence no doubt reflects the quandary faced by the U.S. administration in proving its allegations. This issue, these allegations have become a subject of ridicule. The issue is no more than a small, experimental, primitive aircraft without any form of production whatsoever. Inspection teams have viewed the aircraft, its specifications, and their details. They ascertained those specifications, especially regarding fuel tank capacity and engine specifications. It was tested within the range of the airport. This is a radio-controlled aircraft. It is controlled and remains within the sight range of its ground controller. No more than 8 kilometers. Therefore, it is not a weapon of mass destruction. Neither is it a delivery method which goes beyond the range set in Security Council resolutions. Is this a material breach of Security Council resolutions, and particularly 1441? This we leave to you, ladies and gentlemen. We leave it to you to ascertain the truth of such allegations. They show the bankruptcy of the U.S. administration in attempting to convince the international community of the truthfulness of its allegations. The issue ultimately is in the hands of UNMOVIC. It is UNMOVIC that is to reach its conclusions. Mr. President, I should like to conclude my statement in pointing out the following 2 points. One, Iraq is aware that since the start of our dealing with this matter, that the United States and America and Britain will put in doubt any result reached because their goal is not disarmament, a disarmament which has in effect been achieved. And they know this, as will be ascertained by ANMOVIC and IAEA soon. Rather, their objective is to lay their hands on our oil, to control the region, to redraw its borders in order to ensure the vital interests of the United States of America for a long period to come. This is a new direct colonization of the region. My second and last point is that Iraq has taken the strategic decision to rid itself of weapons of mass destruction.
Mohammed al-Douri, Iraq's ambassador to the UN, speaking through a translator. Kuwaiti ambassador to the UN, Mohammed al-Buhassan, places the onus on Iraq to move peace forward. Al-Buhassan asserted that Iraq had failed to comply with UN resolutions calling for its immediate disarmament and full cooperation with weapons inspectors. Al-Buhassan speaking through a translator.
Kuwait hopes that the Council will be able to go beyond differences of opinion and divisions within it, for this jeopardizes its basic responsibility for maintaining international peace and security. We hope that it will be able to arrive at an agreement that truly reflects the common determination of the international community and the firm resolve to confront any political maneuvering on the part of the Iraqi leadership. This is a type of maneuvering that is commonly used by the Iraqi leadership whenever pressure is ratcheted up. We've seen in the past that the only winner when there is division is the Iraqi leadership, because differences of opinion are in fact a goal sought by the Iraqi leadership. They do everything they can to bring about such differences of opinion, because this is how they can then elude their obligations and weaken the resolve of the Council and prevent it from implementing the resolutions.
Kuwaiti ambassador to the UN, Mohammed al-Buhassan, speaking through a translator. South Africa's ambassador, Dumisani Khumalo, stated that millions are against the war on Iraq, that any war in the region would have negative consequences not only for the Middle East, but also for Africa.
Mr. President, we come before you under the gathering clouds of war. Millions of people around the world have openly rejected this war and believe, as we do, that this war is not necessary. A war against Iraq will be deadly, destabilizing, and have far-reaching political, socio-economic, and humanitarian consequences for all the countries of the world. For us in Africa, the impact of this pending war will indeed be crippling. It is for this reason that we appreciate the opportunity to share our views with the Security Council at this critical time. The decision the Security Council is about to take will undoubtedly transcend the immediate issue of Iraq. It would appear to us that we are no longer debating the situation in Iraq and that country's full compliance with United Nations Security Council Resolution 1441, but that we are currently defining a new international order that will determine how the international community addresses conflict situations in the future. This is an extremely serious issue which needs our careful consideration and which will have far-reaching implications as we progress into this new millennium. We have to remind ourselves that the founders of the United Nations were motivated by an abhorrence of war and by a commitment to resolving international conflicts peacefully and through collective action.
Dumisani Khumalo, South African ambassador to the UN, addressing a meeting today of the non-aligned nations. The first permanent international court for crimes against humanity began its work in The Hague today. But in a reflection of the Bush administration's opposition to the court, no U.S. official is scheduled to be present when the judges take their oaths in a 13th century hall. Despite U.S. opposition, court officials put the best face on matters yesterday in talking about plans for the gala inauguration, which will be attended by Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan, and scores of visiting dignitaries, including two members of the Allied prosecution team at the Nuremberg trials. Robert Knight of Pacifica Station WB AI in New York has more in this report.
The International Criminal Court has as its mandate the prosecution of individuals for war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. In that sense, it differs from the UN's previously established International Court of Justice, which litigates interstate disputes. 89 nations have ratified the court so far, and according to John Washburn, convener of American Non-Governmental Organizations for the International Criminal Court, the court is ready for operations.
We have just elected the 18 judges of the court. Most of the major nations of Western Europe are represented. Scandinavia is represented by a judge from Finland. There are judges from Italy, Germany, France, the United Kingdom. There are judges from a number of African countries, including Mali and South Africa, come to mind. There's a judge from South Korea. There's a judge from Latvia, a judge from Ireland and Britain, judges from a number of Latin American countries. All the regions of the world and all the principal legal systems of the world are represented among them, and 7 of the 18 are women. They will be sworn in at an impressive ceremony in The Hague. In the meantime, the prosecutor and the registrar will be officially appointed by the court's governing body, the Assembly of States Parties, in April. Following that, the court will have all of its necessary elements. It is expected to begin reviewing cases and complaints in the summer, June or July, and to have the first trial underway by the end of 2004.
The International Criminal Court would operate differently from current prosecutions, such as the Belgian pursuit of alleged war criminals such as Generals Ariel Sharon and Augusto Pinochet.
Those cases all had to do with domestic courts. The right of a domestic court to try a person whose crimes, who was not a citizen of the country of the court, and whose crimes had been committed elsewhere than in the country of the court. There is a legal principle called universal jurisdiction, under which a number of nations have made it possible for trials like that to take place in their courts by new suitable provisions in their domestic criminal law. By contrast, the International Criminal Court is an international organization, an international court created by a treaty and which applies law provided for it in that treaty. Although there are obviously some similarities, basically these are two very different ways of trying somebody.
According to its mandate, the International Criminal Court could not intervene on behalf of immigrants, so-called illegal combatants, and other detainees being held incommunicado or without counsel at Guantanamo, Bagram, and other U.S. facilities, since presumed constitutional violations are a domestic matter as far as the court is concerned. But under its mandate to prosecute genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, it is conceivable that the Bush administration's planned shock and awe bombing campaign in Iraq could be actionable, with Commander-in-Chief George W. Bush as a potential defendant.
If that course of action resulted in widespread civilian deaths, and the Commander-in-Chief was aware of that and didn't care, or was turned his back on it, then the deaths of those civilians could be a war crime, and it could be ascribed to a head of state. A person's position, it does not grant immunity from the court's jurisdiction.
But as with the United Nations itself, the enforcement power of the International Criminal Court relies not on the force of arms, but on the extent to which participating nations honor their treaty obligations.
Although this may seem feeble, In fact, as we have seen from the Rwanda and Yugoslav tribunals, countries are in many cases very anxious and willing to cooperate with the court and to produce people that the court is seeking to take into custody for trial. A second avenue to enforcement lies with the Security Council, which may refer a matter to the court for examination and for trial if deemed appropriate. A referral by the court to the court by the Security Council would come under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter. Chapter 7 gives the Security Council the right to give orders which must be obeyed to any government which is a member of the United Nations. And so this would be an additional important power which the court could enjoy through those Chapter 7 powers of the Security Council under the UN Charter.
Thus, it is unlikely but not inconceivable that George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair, in the event of war crimes during an unsanctioned attack on Iraq, could themselves become hypothetical targets of prosecution and enforcement by the same United Nations Security Council from which they are currently seeking authorization for war. John Washburn is a convener of the American NGO Coalition for the International Criminal Court. And in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Peace Watch.
Secretary General Kofi Annan warned today that if the United States fails to win approval from the Security Council for an attack on Iraq, Washington's decision to act alone or outside the council would violate the United Nations Charter. The members of the Security Council now face a great choice, Annan said at The Hague, where he is trying to broker a United Nations deal on Cyprus. If they fail to agree on a common position and action is taken without the authority of the Security Council, the legitimacy and support for any such action will be seriously impaired, said Annan. Annan's remarks drew a sharp response from Washington, where the Bush administration, like its allies overseas, was engaged in strong lobbying efforts to win the necessary 9 votes to pass the resolution this week, authorizing war. That vote has since been delayed by the U.S. The White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said in a strongly worded retort that, from a moral point of view, if the United States, or rather if the United Nations, fails to support the Bush administration's war aims, it will have failed to act once again. As it did in Kosovo in the face of persecution of the ethnic Albanians by Serbia, and earlier in Rwanda in the face of widespread massacres by Hutus against Tutsis. One of Bush's strongest allies, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, is coming under heavy attack in the British Parliament for his support of the war. British Parliament member Peter Kilfoyle is a former defense minister for Tony Blair, but he does not support his position on Iraq. During an interview earlier today with Peace Watch, we talked of Blair's need for passage of a second UN resolution, and we asked if anything less would amount to political suicide for Tony Blair.
It's looking increasingly that way, and the reasons are simple. First of all, his own party takes the view, that's the Labour Party to which I belong, that there are two, if you like, preconditions for military action by the UK. One is a second United Nations resolution, and secondly, that has to be based upon credible evidence. Currently, we're having lots of debates here in the House of Commons on this, and the evidence is being held to scrutiny and is found unconvincing of the case for going to war. Not that it's all necessarily wrong in itself, but, for example, I moved an amendment that the case for military action is as yet unproven, and there was quite a rebellion within the Labour Party itself against Tony Blair's line. But secondly, he has to take on board public opinion in the United Kingdom. And that is consistently shown that the electorate in the United Kingdom also expects the Prime Minister to have a second United Nations resolution. So obviously, for Tony Blair, if there was no second UN resolution and if he was committed British forces alongside American forces in a unilateral action, it would pose very, very grave dangers for him.
Mr. Kilfoyle, how would you describe the sentiment or the way that the British Parliament stands on this particular issue of a second resolution, as whether for or against this war against Iraq? Are most of them in favor of it, against it? How would you characterize it?
I would characterize it that the majority, I wouldn't say the vast majority, but I'm sure that the majority want a second resolution within this parliament. I would characterise it by saying that I've been 13 years in this House and 40 years in the Labour Party. I've never known an issue to be so acutely felt and argued in all of that time. That's not just my opinion. I keep hearing this from colleagues all of the time. There are very sincere convictions on either side of the argument. But it really has polarised opinion in a way which we haven't had for a very long time. And the second thing that I would say is that it's thrown up the most unlikely cross-party alliances within our system, both for and against military action. Mm. It really is a unique occasion. It's one of those rare occasions which are very, very high politics, but sincerely argued and felt.
Indeed, Claire Short, the British International Development Secretary, has threatened to resign if Tony Blair goes ahead with the war in Iraq without a UN debate. Do you see any opportunity for the Parliament to change its position on this?
No. And in fact, the government's tactics are such that I would be highly doubtful that the opportunity will be given for what we would describe as a substantive motion where people can vote for or against war. You have to remember that in the United States you have a War Powers Act, and no matter how it's used, presidents now, well, since the 70s, they go to Congress, and Congress gives its support, invariably. We don't have that kind of mechanism. A Prime Minister in the United Kingdom can declare war on who he likes without reference to anybody. He acts under a very archaic royal prerogative, which has never been changed for hundreds of years.
Mm. Aside from the political risk for Tony Blair personally, what might be the downside for Britain internationally, globally, if the Parliament decides to side with Bush and to go to war without the UN?
Well, let me say, first of all, nobody wants to have a breach with the United States. That is neither realistic politically, militarily, economically, nor emotionally. There are huge bonds, as you know, between the UK and the United States. But at the same time, because of the way in which this thing has evolved, there are huge risks internationally for Britain with its European Union partners, and that's where 60% of our trade goes. There are risks to British interests throughout the Arab and Islamic world. Now, there are occasions when you have to sublimate those into a greater moral cause, perhaps. But many of us don't feel that this is one of those. And it actually does prejudice British interests. The question, I suppose, is how do we move out of this apparent deadlock and away from this divisiveness, which seems to have taken hold of old and long-established alliances.
Hmm. And what about the possible downside if Britain doesn't go along with the U.S.?
Well, I find that inconceivable, you see. I don't see how Tony Blair can resile from his repeated commitment to standing shoulder to shoulder with George Bush.
Hmm. It sounds like you're saying, Mr. Kilfoyle, that Tony Blair is likely to side with Bush and to just basically ignore whatever position the Parliament comes up with?
I think he might very well do that. And we haven't got to that stage, to be fair. There's still negotiations going on in the United Nations. If there was a short, sharp military action with relatively few casualties, including civilian casualties, he could claim that he'd stood shoulder to shoulder with George Bush and they'd done a good thing and everything was fine. The problem is, of course, if things go wrong. A large number of casualties, getting bogged down in urban warfare, a large number of civilian casualties. British public opinion would not countenance that. But the other issue is later on, if indeed there is a dismemberment of Iraq, if there are further instabilities created in the Middle East, if we have regime change of a different sort in hitherto friendly countries, if there is an increase and an upsurge in terrorism because such an action would act as a recruiting sergeant for the terrorists, then there would be major, major problems.
Mm-hmm. As you said earlier, this is still in the diplomatic arena at the UN, but France has pretty much dug its heels in and said, Prime Minister Jacques Chirac has said basically whatever happens, they are going to vote no for war. And France is a permanent member of the council with veto power, which basically means that the resolution will not pass if he holds to that.
That's true, and I think Russia's given similar indications. But you see, over here, we're mindful that both the United Kingdom and the U.S. governments have used the veto regularly in the past, very, very much more than France or Russia, when it was convenient to their own national interest. So the idea of the French, or indeed the Russians, using the veto is not necessarily anathema to us, simply because it's been a regular feature of the U.N., and indeed, when the UN was designed and constructed, it was put in there to ensure that there was a consensus about these issues of great moment.
There has been much talk about the UN being rendered irrelevant if it does not rise to this occasion. What are your thoughts about that?
I worry about it greatly because I have a lot of American friends and correspondents who email me and telephone me and tell me that this is not their view, that the administration, the president's administration, seems to have set its face against the UN as a positive body. I would argue that the founding fathers of the UN, and indeed the founding fathers of the League of Nations, aspired to a forum, an international forum, where people could talk their way through some of these problems rather than resort to war. And I think that's extremely laudable. I think it's the best thing that we have. And I think it would be America's loss and the United Kingdom's loss. It would be the whole world's loss if the UN was to be damaged. With all its imperfections, with all of its frailties, it's the best hope that we have for pulling countries together in one direction. The fear is that without the United Nations, it will just be, it'll be chaotic. It will be, you know, the powerful will rule and the devil take the hindmost. And the danger of that, of course, is that we've seen many powerful countries in history and they have their period in the sun. But eventually, you know, it diminishes. And we never, ever know what's around the corner, what potential dangers there are. So that kind of, if you like, survival of the fittest approach to international diplomacy, I don't think is a positive way forward. I really hope that my own government and the American government and other governments, the French and the Russians and whatever, are taking very, very seriously what's happening to, potentially to the UN.
You think that's what's at stake here?
I think it could be. I know there are different voices which come out, for example, of the administration. But we all recognize the truth of the matter, that American influence is so important and so all-pervasive on this planet. America is the sole superpower, but it doesn't have a monopoly of wisdom in these areas, so the argument goes. And people are very, very anxious that the United States should remain part of these international frameworks rather than outside and above them.
British Parliament member Peter Kilfoyle is a former defense minister for Tony Blair. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.
Raise the blade, trim the rot. Are you ready to be shot? Do we want a war? Anybody listening? Haven't we learned anything? What's the point of killing when it hasn't worked before? Before the final culture clash, before this fragile piece is smashed, before we all do something rash, back it up. Situation simmer, nothing to consider. Implications of a war, nobody will win. Fundamental chaos, fighting for the right to use God's name and everything related to the cause. Everybody, everybody breathe. Everybody, everybody believe. Before we step right off the edge, before we are at war instead, before we start to count the dead, back it up.
Everybody breathes, everybody believes.
We elect
how many they're prepared to lose. Put in power, supposedly, to rescue us from death's decree.
Everybody breathes, everybody breathes.
James Blondale, back it up.